So welcome to the Friday Night Inner Space Talk. We have Benoit joining us from the south of France, and the topic is reclaiming your creative self. Benoit is currently a script writer and film director and a producer. It looks like in the future he'll be coming out from behind the camera and being interviewed. So I'm looking forward to seeing some of those clips. Benoit has worked in so many different creative frontiers. There's been the advertising world in Paris. He's lived in New York working in a creative capacity. He's been a managing director for the French luxury fashion house in New York. And he's exhibited his color watercolor artwork, and I think we can see some of it in the background in a palace gallery. So he's an artist, a painter, as well as a director, as well as a director of film, but also of a fashion house. So I'm looking forward to being able to hear what makes Benoit move forward through different creative means, and what's been the thing that sparks his creativity, fires it up, and how has he maintained his creative courage and patience on the journey? After Benoit's talk, we're going to be he's going to do a short meditation, just 3 minutes with us, and then after that, he'll be taking your questions. I'm going to ask you to put your questions in the question and answer link. And then I will take those questions and put them to Benoit on your behalf. So, Benoit, over to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, actually, I don't define myself as an artist at all. Artist, anyway, is a label. And so tonight, what I would like to do is to tell you that a cliche can be true for once. And, definitely the cliche that everybody is creative has been true for me. And the other thing I would like to tell you tonight is that for me, creativity and spirituality always work hand in hand. So let me tell you a little bit about myself. I was not brought up in creativity. I was, brought up in as a regular Frenchman, meaning, our education system is based on Descartes, very rational things, which is great because it allowed me to go about life. But I remember what's supposed to be our artist classes. And let's be honest, the teachers never gave us the feeling, never encouraged our creativity. And by the way, I like very much what Paul McCartney defined as his music classes when he was in the school with George Harrison in Liverpool. And he said, basically, the music teacher would put a record, then he would go out to smoke a cigarette. Meanwhile, the students were playing cards. That's what it was. So they never gave him and gave them a feeling of music. So it came afterwards by themselves. So anyway, then I took an MBA in business school. So again, not so very creative. Then I worked in markets research, and market research is statistics and figures. So yes, if you look at Einstein was very creative with mathematics, but again, for me, it was not so creative. So then I became, as Artie said, the director of one of the old-fashioned French houses in New York. And again, it was management. Even though I enjoyed working with the stylists, it was really, I was on the management side. But it was New York. And New York was a fascinating city. I'm talking mid-70s, mid-80s.
Wow.
And yes, it was really a fascinating city. And I mean, You could. I remember one day standing at the corner of Broadway and 72nd, calling for a yellow cab, and I could feel the energy coming from the pavement, the sidewalk, as they call it, through my body. You know, it's like that. It was like that for me. So when I was in New York, something started to boil in me, and I did two things. First, I started to read books which I had never read before. And I remember being in Central Park and reading the Bhagavad Gita and reading, you know, about the Rosicrucians and reading about Zen meditation and I mean pell-mell and reading about Carl Jung and Gurdjieff and all that. And at the same time, I took classes, singing lessons, exactly, singing lessons with a teacher from the Juilliard School of Music. And I took saxophone lessons, but the neighbors didn't like it so much. And I took modern dancing lessons with Alvin Ailey on Times Square, and that was fabulous. And I took painting, oil painting lessons with a teacher from Oklahoma who was coming and giving some lessons about that. So, you know, creativity and spirituality were starting to grow in me in parallel. And really in New York, I had three epiphanies. One, the first one, as I said, I was coming from Paris. So for me, painting was mostly impressionists and Monet and Manet and, you know, Berthe Morisot and Renoir and so on. And I didn't know anything about modern art. So one day I went to one of my favorite museums, which is the Guggenheim in New York, and there was a Mark Rothko exhibition. And so, you know, you arrive downstairs in the Guggenheim, which is actually the end of the exhibition. And so I was facing a huge black canvas. And I wondered, what am I doing here? And I almost left, but then I thought, no, wait a minute. Let's start the exhibition from the beginning. So you take the elevator, you go on top of the museum, and you know the museum is a spiral like that. And so you go through the evolution of the painter, of the artist. And I remember Mark Rothko's painting at the beginning was a bit of symbolism and a bit of expressionism. And you could see that he was looking for his style. And he even went into kind of Jackson Pollock, very complicated kind of painting. And suddenly there's a shift. And suddenly you see yourself in front of three rectangles of different colors. And in yourself, in the visitor, there was also a shift. Suddenly, I was not looking at the paintings in the same way. Suddenly, you know, the only thing I had to do was to look at those rectangles of colors and feel, just feel. So some mix of colors, I was feeling good in them, and some I was feeling cold or feeling warm, whatever. I wasn't thinking, I was just trying to feel. And then, you know, in Mark Rothko's painting, after three rectangles of bright colors, then you go into two squares of gray, grayer and grayer color, until at the end of the exhibition, and indeed at the end of his life, you logically, you have a huge square of black painting. So for me, it was interesting because really, there was this shift, and I didn't know what this shift was about at first, but I will tell you later on. My second epiphany in New York was when my girlfriend took me to the premiere at the Metropolitan Opera of The Catherine Wheel by Twyla Tharp, you know, a modern ballet. And again, I didn't know anything about modern ballet. And I was stunned. I mean, I was sitting on, when the lights came on, my girlfriend, who didn't really get it, she thought I was joking because I couldn't move. And I had my mouth open. I was so amazed by what I had seen. And again, you know, it was I was just in it. I was in the ballet. I took it like that, full face, and I was really, I mean, it was a spiritual experience, really. The third epiphany I had in New York, I just had a car accident in a Jeep that overturned, that I was not driving, and I had a big bump on my head, and this may explain that. And so I was in our house in East Hampton, and my friends told me, listen, we are going to a dinner party. Can you watch Charlotte Jane, 5 years old, and Alison, 7 and a half, during the evening? I said, sure, fine. And so here we were in this room filled with books, and the girls, the two little girls who were very cute, were playing, and of course they were noisy, and the TV was on, and I took from the shelf a book by chance, which was that book. Can you see it? Drawing on the Right Side of the Brain by Betty Edwards. And I was, this book was amazing, because what Betty Edwards tells you is that we think that we see, but in fact, we see what we think. That means when you were a child in those drawing classes that I mentioned, you know, they told me, well, if you want to paint a tree, you will paint a lot of green and you will paint a brown trunk. Okay. And then for the rest of your adult life, you don't draw, you don't paint. So when then you are asked to draw or to paint again, and you want to paint a tree, what do? You paint a lot of green and a brown trunk. But do you actually see the tree? If you look closely at the tree, if you learn to see the tree differently, you will see that there is a lot of blue, a lot of red, a lot of yellow, a lot of white, a lot of dark, black, and a lot of terra siena, and so on and so on, a lot of colors. And so what she says is that what happened is that during our adult life, we have been functioning from the left brain, the left hemisphere, which again was fine because, you know, it allows you to go about life. But the problem is that left hemisphere has taken control and it has overpowered the right hemisphere. So what you should do is to try to get the right hemisphere to express itself and to untrigger the left hemisphere. So how can you do that? So she says, we have to put the left hemisphere in situations that he cannot handle. Like, for instance, she says, one of the most difficult things to draw or to paint, especially when you're a beginner, are portraits, okay? So you turn the page of the book and you have this. Meaning you have a portrait upside down. And she says, the left hemisphere cannot handle upside down. So the left hemisphere says to the right hemisphere, okay, you do it because I don't know what it is. I cannot do upside down. And so, you know, what's important is that, so I did that exercise. And she says, don't think. Don't think that you are drawing eyes or that you are drawing a nose or a mouth. Because if you do that, then the left hemisphere will tell you, oh, eyes, I know how to do that. No, forget it. Just don't even draw lines. You just draw the shades. So you draw the dark shades, the lighter shades, the middle shades, and so on and so on. And I did that exercise. And you know, after that, I turned the book so that the portrait was in the right way. And I turned what I had just drawn and I compared both. And I was amazed because it was good, which gave me self-confidence because I didn't know I could draw until then. And what's even more interesting is that while I was doing this drawing with the right brain, I forgot where I was. I forgot the room. I forgot the girls playing. I forgot the noise. I forgot the TV. I forgot about time. I couldn't tell you how long it took me to do this drawing. It might have been 5 minutes or 1 hour. I don't know. So that to me, you know, there was a click here, something that happened. I realized that there is a whole sphere of my being that I have not really explored, and that I have always functioned in the same way, more or less, but that I could reawaken or reclaim my creativity if I started to use more of this right hemisphere kind of thing. She gives more, you know, examples. I will not tell all of them, but two of them shortly. If you have to draw one of these old wooden chair, you know, with a lot of bars, if you have to draw like an old bridge, like there is in Giverny, for instance, you know, again with a lot of bars, it's very, if you try to draw the lines because they are crossing each other, forget it, it's very complicated. But if you, instead of drawing the lines, you draw the space between the lines, between the bars. Again, left hemisphere doesn't know the space. Left hemisphere knows the lines, doesn't know the space. So then suddenly you're not drawing a chair anymore. You're drawing rectangles, triangles, squares, and you will see the result is amazing. Another example, which I have experienced, and which is quite interesting, is if you are at an airport or if you are in a railroad station, any kind of public place, and you have to wait, you do quick sketching. Quick sketching, again, left hemisphere cannot handle that. Quick sketching is you don't have time to think. You know, you have people who are moving in front of you and you are just trying to catch their attitude. You know, to catch their the position of the body and to, yeah, more catch the attitude, so that in just a few strokes like that, you can describe what they are doing. That's quite an interesting exercise to do. So anyway, learn to see is really something very important. And so, you know, and this can apply not only to drawing and things like that, but it can apply to many things in life. And I will come to that later on. But first of all, I want to tell you the kind of processes which I use in creativity, because there are many ways to be creative. You have people who are creative, you know, with a very strict discipline, and they wake up early in the morning and they start writing, and they have a very, all the timetable is like that, very organized. You have people who can only be creative if they are at the terrace of a bistro, which I guess would have been difficult for them lately. You can be creative in a forest and so on and so on. I have two processes, creative processes, which I would like to share with you. And it's interesting because they are almost opposite. The first one is when I write a scenario. And as I said, I've written about 15 to 20 scenarios. Sorry. And in fact, I don't write anything. What I do is that I feel the need, and it's very important, I feel the need to express something. For example, two examples. I feel the need to talk about Oscar Wilde's portrait of Dorian Gray, but upside down. And at the same time, I feel the need to say that history books, which only talk about battles and wars and defeats and victories and so on, miss the point. And the point is that maybe, probably, I imagine that behind all those battles and those wars and so on, there has been meetings of people and meetings of culture. So you know, you take those two things and you think, is it too much? Can it work together? How can you build a script with that? Another example is I feel the need to talk about the power of thoughts and to link it somehow with quantum physics. And at the same time, in the same scenario, I want to show the contrast between traders on the commodity market and people working in humanity organizations. And so, you know, I'm just giving you example. I'm just throwing examples like that. But the thing is, I start with this. I feel the need of. I don't write anything. I sleep on it. Then I take my bicycle, ride my bicycle either in the forest or I go to the beach. Then I swim. And I let the right hemisphere do its work, basically. I still don't write anything, but I start to picture places. I start to picture historical context or scientific context, whatever. And then characters are coming. I start to picture characters. And so then, still on my bicycle, trying to feel, well, I see the characters very clearly, but I want to see where they go. So, you know, if this one goes that way and this one goes this way and they cross here and what happens and so on, no, it doesn't work, so we start again. And I play with the characters like you would do on a chessboard. And it's only when I have the beginning, the middle, and the end that I write, that I start writing. And when I write, some very interesting things happen. First, it comes very easily. It comes with the dialogues immediately. And it comes, every line is a clear image in my mind, and that's very important. You will see why afterwards. And strangely enough, it comes to me in English. Don't ask me why. Or maybe I know why. It's because, precisely as I said, I've been brought up, French is my native language, and it's the left hemisphere for me. Rational, analytical, and all that. Whereas English, it has always been easier for me to express my feelings in English somehow. And I've noticed that when I was living in New York and when I was really thinking and feeling in English. So, and I find English language is much more creative, actually, much more direct, much more spontaneous, you know, in writing. Meaning, when I write in French, I write words. When I write in English, I write images. See the difference? Because I wrote books a long time ago. And that was one way of writing, which I now, when I read the books that I wrote, I find a bit pompous or rigid, let's say. But when I write a script, it's fun. It's fun and it works and there is a rhythm and all that. So then when it comes to directing the film, or even before that, during the rehearsal, during the casting and the rehearsals, well, of course, because I have every line is a very clear image for me. So, you know, the professional actors, who by the way are great, they have already learned the text, but they are still unsure of how to play their character. So I can guide them exactly on the way I see their character. And then and I do the same with technicians, because, you know, they ask me, where would you like the lights to come from, or which angle with the camera and so on. I know exactly. And I know the decors and I know the costumes and everything. But at the same time, where it becomes interesting is that when the actors get into their character, they give me an input from the way they feel the character, which is usually great. And it adds a lot to the script. And same with the technicians. And also, you know, sometimes I have to do, because I have little budget, so sometimes I have to do with what I have. So you have to improvise. You have to adapt the decor that you had in mind with what you have and see how it works, and which is also a very creative process. And then when it comes to the editing is something else again, because editing, it's synchronizing, it's a rhythm. But editing, it's also a school of detachment, because you have filmed a scene, you have shot a scene, which to you seems important. But then when you come to editing, you realize, is it really important? Is it really necessary for me to keep this scene? Get rid of it. Then you get rid of it. And in fact, it works. And in fact, the rhythm is even better, and it's shorter and everything like that. So many things to learn about. So that was my first process of creativity. The second process of creativity is a little bit what you have behind. It has to do with, I love watercolors. I love watercolors for many reasons, which I will tell you afterwards. But, like most people, I used to paint very traditional watercolors, meaning a beautiful little house from the Provence where I live, with beautiful flowers around and a cypress tree and all that, like Tuscany kind of landscape, which is great. But once you have done that, then so what? You know, what's next? So my watercolors have become more and more abstract, and more and more I'm playing with the colors themselves. So in fact, because I've already spoken a lot, how would you feel that we do a little creative inner space moment of reflection together? Would you like to go into your inner space, meaning that, you know, you relax the arms, you relax the shoulders, you relax the neck and everything, just sit comfortably. You can leave your eyes open and you can close your eyes, and you go into your inner space. So usually we place the inner space somewhere behind the forefront, but never mind that. You are in your inner space, right? Your inner space is that place, that space that belongs to you. Nobody can invade it. It's a place where you feel very secure, very safe. It's a place that where you can go anytime, wherever you are, whatever you are doing, you just go and sit in your inner space. That it is that kind of dimension, which is very light, very clear, very beautiful. You know, no worries, no nothing. If thoughts want to come and invade your inner space, very gently, you just tell them, wait outside. Right now, I want to enjoy my inner space. That's it, you know. So I will deal with you later on. And today, in our inner space, we have a large piece of special watercolor paper, large white piece of special watercolor paper. And next to it, you have a big fat watercolor brush like this one, right? And by the way, the watercolor paper is your consciousness. The brush, or the brushes, if you have several of them, are your senses. So you dip the watercolor brush in some water, the water being your subconscious, and you let it really absorb the water, right? And then with a lot of water on your brush, you choose a color. The colors are the outside influences. So you will choose, for instance, a royal blue, right? Royal blue. So you take a lot of, you know, take a lot of colors. So you have this brush with a lot of water, a lot of colors, and you just gently lay it on the paper. But don't be shy, you know, it's not like pastels. Watercolors can be very bright. So you have a very honest and very frank stroke like that. Don't hesitate. Then you may have a second stroke like that. Okay. Then you clean your brush. And again, you take some, you dip your brush in some clean, transparent water, and you choose another color. You will choose, for instance, a bright yellow, and you will apply the brush right at the border where you had put the blue. And like that, you know, and you see what happens. And it's very interesting because it starts, you know, the colors mix, of course, so you have some green in the middle, and the colors, the mix of the water, the paper, and the pigment start to, you know, to spread in a star, in star-like form. What you can even do is that then you clean your brush again and you dip your brush, you soak your brush with clean water, and you just splash the paper where you had put the water, so that, you know, you spread it even more, and you give it an effect even more of sparkling like that, and a star effect. And, you know, what I like about watercolor is precisely, well, first of all, it's light and it's spontaneous. And so, you know, it works or it doesn't work. If it doesn't work, you just throw it away, terminate. But if it works, then what happens is that you don't control it. You cannot control everything. It's really the mix of the paper, the water, and the pigment which makes it happen. And depending on the quality of the paper, depending on the amount of water, or depending on the pigment, you can have a different result. So, of course, with experience, you may have an idea of what it will be. But, you know, it just happens and you cannot control it. And the third thing that I like about watercolor is that the most beautiful thing in a watercolor is light. You know, the worst is when a watercolor is all done everywhere. So the most beautiful part of the watercolor is light. But what is light in a watercolor? It's the white of the paper. In other words, the most beautiful part of watercolor is what you don't paint, which is an interesting concept, not only for watercolor, but also for life, isn't it? Meaning that, you know, in life, you cannot control everything. And in life, you may speak to people and they will only listen to one word out of 10 what you say, but hopefully they will feel some kind of light that they will like, and that's what will go through. So that's, you know, I introduce now this. When we talk about creativity, just one thing. When I said that my creative process about watercolor is almost the opposite of the other one, is that when I start a watercolor, I have no idea, no preconceived idea, no special need or anything. I don't want to think. I don't have any page fright. I just go about it. And I see how it works. As I said, it works or it doesn't work. But that's what I like about watercolors. And, you know, if it works, then you're happy and you keep it and you can even exhibit it, even though I don't really like exhibition. It's not really my best part. But I wanted to introduce that because, We usually associate creativity with art and art with beauty, but there is also creativity in life. And that's probably the highest form of creativity. And so, you know, it becomes really very interesting when you can ask yourself, what new can I bring into my life? How can I transform myself? How can I transform my life? And then you can be very creative about that. Like one tool that I use to be creative in my life, meaning, you know, you can look at your life and you can look at yourself in a different angle, in a different perspective. That's what artists do, don't they? One thing that I find very useful is gratitude. Like, you know, you, like this afternoon, I went shopping and I was in the supermarket where I usually go. So instead of being impatient and stressed and maybe at some time arrogant, especially when if you have to wait online at the cashier and so on, you just stop and you look around you and you know, you realize how lucky I am to be in a country where I can find in abundance everything I need and everything I desire, where I can buy all my chocolate and everything like that. And you know, I mean, I'm so lucky. And just doing that, suddenly you shift your whole attitude, and you shift your whole life, because, you know, after all, reality exists only in the eyes of the one who sees it. And so, you know, we always say, if you change your vision, you change the world. That's what Gandhi said also. Well, it's a very creative process in a way. So when you arrive at the cashier and this woman is doing this work 8 hours a day, you know, instead of being grumpy and impatient, if you just smile at her and maybe joke with her, you can be sure she will smile back at you, because there is a mirror effect. And if you're grumpy, people, and if you're, you know, you don't trust people, people will think, who is this person? So they will also not trust you. But, you know, if a smile can do so much, as we know. And so in that sense, a smile can be very creative. And also, if I'm creative in my way of looking at others, it may wake them up to who they really are. It may wake their own creativity. So that means also that, you know, instead of starting the day and being very stressed and everything, you can start the day giving yourself 15 minutes, half an hour, never mind, and waking up a little bit early. And as Sister Shivani said, be thankful to your mind, thankful to your body, thankful to the people around you, and thankful to the objects that you use and all this technology that allowed us to speak tonight. You know, change your perspective, be thankful like that. I mean, that I find is a very creative way. So that means that if you are in meditation or if you are in prayer or if you are in positive thinking, whatever it is, renew yourself. Don't make it so that your meditation is the same every day. Be creative in your meditation. And that's why I say creativity and spirituality work hand in hand, because to me, it's clear that I need creativity in my spirituality, and I put spirituality definitely in my creativity. I would like, because I think that my time is almost over, I would just like to end. There would be much more things to say, but I would like to end with one quote, which I love, from Kandinsky. Vasily Kandinsky was asked, Master, why do you put, you know, blue here and red here and so on? And Vasily Kandinsky's answer was, Le principe de la nécessité intérieure, literally speaking, the principle of inner necessity. And to me, everything is there. The principle of inner necessity. In other words, that's why, you know, when we talked about my creative process before writing a script, I insisted on the fact of I feel the need of. If you have this inner necessity, if you feel this inner necessity to express something, then the sky is the limit. Then don't have any doubt about yourself. Then go for it. Don't think, I don't have the skills and, you know, I don't know how to draw. Forget about that. If you have the inner necessity, you can do it. And that's what I've been doing all my life. You know, I was never trained to write scripts. I was never trained to direct films and so on. But as soon as I was on a set and I said action, everybody on the set knew that I had done that all my life, because there was this inner necessity. So this inner necessity also for me meets another concept, which is from a very interesting Englishman called Ken Robinson, who is a great advocate of creativity from a very early age in education. And he says, you have to be in your element. You don't know what your element is, but when you find your element, you know you're there. And when you're in your element, you have the kind of experience that I had when I was drawing in that room with the little girls and the TV on. You forget about time, you forget about noise, and you just do it, and it works, and it happens. So that for me is true creativity. Okay, maybe I will stop here.
Thank you.
Right.
Would you like to take a few minutes to do a guided meditation?
Okay, I could do a small guided meditation if you wish. So, let's go back to our inner space. So, you know, again, you're in your inner space. Close your eyes if it helps. You're in your inner space. This space which is very safe and very secure and very peaceful. There's no noise, there's no worries, there's no things. It's very peaceful. It's your space. You can design it the way you want. And very often in my inner space, I have my spiritual swing. And I just sit on my spiritual swing in my inner space. And I just swing. That's all I do. Nothing else. I swing and I feel light and I feel very free. And I just enjoy. I just relax. I don't think. I just take the moment as it is, just swinging in my spiritual swing. And it's really great. And I really love it. And then, you know, feeling that I'm so lucky to be able to enjoy my spiritual swing, even if I'm at the office or in the subway or whatever, then still keeping that, you know, very warm vibration of my spiritual swing, I see the world below. And, you know, I really see it. And I see all these people who are running around and they are very stressed and they have so many worries and many issues. And I know I cannot help them physically, all of them, but maybe I can help them by you know, sending them a little bit of the peace and the serenity which I enjoy, a little bit of this lightness, a lot of this freedom that I love, I can send them a lot of that. And, you know, make them feel a bit lighter, perhaps, about their life and their worries and concerns and everything. And maybe help them to get some perspective about their health issues or whatever they are going through. And maybe help them to introduce some creativity into their life and look at the situation they are in, the relationship they are in a different angle, and look at themselves also with a different perspective. Just being in my swing. I don't move from my swing. I stay in my inner space. And, you know, what's interesting is that it's very easy, yet it's very deep. Because depth doesn't have to be complicated, contrary to what most people think. To me, it's like watercolor. The easier it is, the lighter it is, the most beautiful it is. And also, the most creative and the most efficient it is. So that's my spiritual swing in my inner space, which I enjoy whenever I want, wherever I want. And you can do the same.
That was really beautiful, Benoit. Thank you. I love the idea of sitting on an internal swing. Yeah. I could feel the sun, I could feel the lightness and everything just melting away, including my body. I felt weightless. So yes. Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you. So there's a few questions that have come.
Okay.
The first question I have for you is, you spoke about not having fear of the white on the page.
Yeah.
But what happens if I find myself fearful?
Yeah.
And that's becoming a block to my creative flow. Yes. How do I deal with it?
Okay. The reason why you are fearful, very probably, it's because you want to prove something. It's because you want recognition. It's because you're not, I mean, if we are talking painting or whatever form of creativity it is, it's because you're not being creative for yourself, but you're being creative for others. You know, most cases, the white page syndrome, the white fried page syndrome, that's what it is about. It means you're not in your inner space, you're not in your inner necessity, you're not in your element. You're outside, your left hemisphere. You're not in your self-esteem. You have doubts about your own creativity, which you wouldn't have if you were in your element. Please read Ken Robinson's books. Great. Really, that's all he talks about. And, you know, when you paint or whatever you do it because you feel the inner need to do it. Stay with that. The rest will happen. If, you know, people are going to see it, if it gets exhibited, if it gets, of course, I mean, when we write or when we film or when we paint, it's usually because we want to be seen or we want to be shown or read. But no, you know, I think every good writers will tell you that they first write for themselves and they write Because they start from this inner need that they have. Does it answer your question?
I hope it does for the person, yes. I'm sure they'll come back if they want clarification.
Okay.
The next question is, it kind of goes down that stream slightly. It sounds like you invest lots of time and energy into the creative process and the output. As a consequence, how do you manage not to get caught up in the ego of your work? As you mentioned at the beginning, you let go of labels.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, of course. The trap of creativity is to get caught up in your ego. And so it's a balance again. Because as I said, when I have to direct and I have to deal with, you know, actors, actresses, and technicians, so I have my image, clear image, but they also give me their input. And so for me, I take it as, you know, they make me richer because they give me their input. So the question is only for me to listen, to be ready to be open to their suggestions. And then I decide. And I decide, you know, if I decide not to do it, I tell them why. And then, you know, it's clear to them, hopefully. But and then with painting, for instance, as I said, for me, watercolors, I do it for the pleasure. And I exhibited once, as you mentioned, in Paris, in the Quartier Latin. That was nice, but it was not my best. I mean, people came, even some people from London came, and it was very nice. But I'm not sure I really liked that. And so yeah, it's always a balance of, you know, what you want to express, and at the same time, being open, listening to other people, and let go. If it is spread, good. If it is not spread, not good. One thing which is interesting about that is that you have done something that you find very creative, whatever it is. Well, let me tell you, your best friends can be the worst enemies of your creativity sometimes. So don't expect. You have this sentence in English, which I love, which is expectation breeds frustration. And that's what it is about. You know, the more creative you are, the less you have to expect anything, right? So don't expect anything. Again, do it for the fun, doing for the pleasure. At best, doing because maybe some kind of message will go through for some people. And you know, what I have found, and it's my own experience, is that it's very funny because when you write a book, whatever it is, make a film, some people get it and some don't. And there's no rule. I don't know why. Some people get it and some don't. It's like the COVID, you know. So you have to accept that. It's a fact of life. I mean, there would be many, many, many explanations, but who cares about going into the explanations? You have done what you thought, what you like. Would you have done what you thought was good? You have done what you thought could help or might help people or might give them, you know, some incentive to develop their own creativity or their own spirituality. If they catch it, fine. If they don't, fine. Right.
Wow. Okay. That was really lovely answer, actually. Can you explain how paper is consciousness and the brush is the senses, etc.?
Yes. Okay. How can I explain that? Well, okay, let's start from the colors. The colors are the influences you receive from the outside world, or in fact, from the inside world as well. In order to put the colors on the paper, you need a brush. So the brush are your senses. You know, the senses are what helps you to communicate with the outside world. And in order to put the color with the brush on the paper, you need the water. So the paper is like a clean slate, you know, and that's where everything happens for you. So it is your consciousness. And the water is always, you know, the symbol of the subconscious. But you need to mix the colors with the water in order to be able to apply it on the paper. And then the way the color, once it is mixed with the water, will spread on the paper is the way you are, the way your consciousness is affected by outside influences, right? So, and that you cannot always control. I mean, so again, with experience, you have an idea of how it can spread on your consciousness, depending on the quality of your consciousness, depending on the amount of pigment that you take, depending on the quality of the water or the cleanness of the water, and the amount of the water also. So you apply it, but if it is not a proper paper, the way it will spread will be completely different, you know? So you have to work with all those elements so that you have the pleasure of painting it and also the result that you want, right? So it's really this mix of playing with the outside influences, your sense organs or your senses, the water, which is your subconscious, and you apply all that gently on your consciousness and you see what happens. Does it answer your question?
That sounds beautiful. Okay. The next question. How do you connect your spirituality with the creative process? You mentioned the ballet that you saw was a spiritual experience.
Yes, completely. I couldn't really describe it because it was really at that time, at that place. But I was completely in my element. When I was hypnotized by that modern ballet, even though I didn't know anything, I didn't think I would like modern ballet. I was hypnotized by it. It was so wonderful. There was a depth in the music, you know, by David Byrne and the ballet by Twyla Tharp. I've never seen it again. I didn't want to see it again, but I remember the feeling. That's the way it resonated in me. And the way it resonated in me, I had the feeling it opened completely. It opened my heart, it opened my mind, I felt completely open. You know, it's a little bit, I would say, at one time in my life, before going to New York, actually, I had a series of car accidents. I had 3 car accidents in 6 months. One of them was really bad. And I was not driving because I had broken my arm playing tennis and my arm was in a cast. And so my friend was driving and I'm in the car and there was no more car. She, who was driving, spent 6 months with a flat back in the hospital. I got out of the car with nothing. And then I had another one and then another one. And you know, those at the already, even though I was not at all on a spiritual journey, those I took as clear signs that I had to change something in my life, change something in my attitude, in my behavior, in the way of looking at things. And that's what eventually brought me to New York, which indeed changed a lot of things for me, and which in fact introduced me to spirituality. So The two things are really interconnected, and yes, in everything I do creatively, there is always a spiritual dimension. I mean, in the two scripts which I just, I just told you the inner needs that originated the scripts, there is an inner need to say something spiritual, but to say it in a way that people can understand first, and in a way that can be, you know, with a spark into it, with something interesting into it, linking it to historical facts and so on. Meaning, you know, making my own synthesis. And that's, for me, it's something that I've done very often. You were talking, when we started, about cooking. I said I don't cook, but in a way, I cook in my mind. That's what it is. I take the ingredients and I take my inner necessity, what I want to express, and then I put all the ingredients in the bowl and I mix it and I see what happens.
Wow, nice. You spoke about bringing newness into your life. Yeah. What is it that inspires newness for you?
It's a need. It's a need. Absolutely a need. And I guess it has always been a need. And I think until the end of my life, it will be a need. It's, especially for people who have experienced difficult lockdowns for long times, the worst thing was to be bored, wasn't it? I mean, one of the worst things. I'm not talking about, you know, whatever violence happened in the places, but newness, yeah, it's a need. I need, so I meditate every day, every morning, and I need it to be new. And, you know, as the same way that I'm exercising on my bicycle and doing 30 to 40 kilometers a day, I need to exercise my mind. And not only my mind, but the mind, the intellect, the heart, and everything. And I want to always increase my balances. You know, I want to always check and increase my balances so that, okay, for instance, I was talking about the right and the left hemisphere. For me, I mean, it's just my experience because I don't have any scientific data for that. But for me, the left hemisphere is masculine and the right hemisphere is feminine. So what spirituality and creativity have helped me to develop is definitely my feminine side. And I love it. And I want to always, the two of them, instead of creating a conflict, you know, I want them to work together and to be balanced and to be in harmony. And I think real creativity, true creativity, happens when your masculine and feminine side are balanced and work together and are complementary, because then you can express the full of yourself. And that's what we want, isn't it? So it's not even a question of newness. It's the question of being a whole. And I want to be the whole of myself. And it's always a process that I'm working on every day.
Interesting. You want to be whole. That's really lovely. All right. I'm going to say thank you, Benoit. Many people have said thank you very much. They've enjoyed the talk. It was inspirational. It's got them thinking. Those are just some of the comments that have come through. So thank you for giving us your time and sharing your insights on creativity.